Last week was one of the hardest weeks I've had in a while. The reason was because Judy was out of town. Judy actually went to Atlanta for this women's conference. And what made it hard is she took our two oldest daughters, but she left me with Mercy, the two-year-old. And the week generally went okay. You know, I went shopping, and the checkout clerk asked me, he said, "Is your wife out of town?" I go to the same guy every time. And I said, "Why do you ask?" And he said, "Because you've never come through here before and bought a case of macaroni and cheese and ramen noodles." And I said, "Hey, pal, it's my kid. I'll take care of her." And, you know, the week went fine. You know, I sort of spent the week trying to get work done on one hand and cleaning up after Mercy on the other hand, because if you know Mercy very well, she tends to be messy. And the night before Judy came home, right, like a good husband, I said, "When Judy gets home, I want her to be so happy and so surprised, and I want the house to be utterly spotless and perfect," right? As I understand, spotless and perfect, but nonetheless. So I stayed up all night and all day, and I cleaned the floor spotlessly. I waxed and polished all of our hardwood floors. I vacuumed. I washed the dog. Everything was perfect, and it was spotless. And that night, I gave Mercy a bath, and we brushed her little teeth, and I took her in her bedroom, and I laid her down to change her. I laid her down on the floor, and as I was changing her, you know, I had the talcum powder, and I you know, sprinkled a little on her bottom. And at that time, she grabbed her Mickey doll. And she says, "I change him, Daddy," and she grabbed Mickey. She tried to grab the talcum powder. And I said, "No, no, Mercy, you don't touch the talcum powder. This is not your thing." And so I set the talcum powder down on the floor, and I put Mercy down. And I went to bed very pleased with myself. I thought, this is so beautiful. Not only is the house perfectly clean, but all I have to do is wake up in the morning, feed Mercy, put her clothes on, and drive to the airport and get Judy. Simple enough. Well, at about 6:30 in the morning, I heard a sound from Mercy's bedroom. And she was going, "I changed him, Daddy! I changed him! Daddy, I changed him! I changed him!" And I heard this sort of theme, the theme from Helter Skelter, started ricocheting through my head. And I ran to her room, and I slid the door open, and every single inch of her room, from the ceiling to the floor, all of her toys, her bed, and Mercy, and of course Mickey, was completely covered with talcum powder. And she was standing at the door with grinning from ear to ear, with, you know, all four of her teeth showing, with Mickey in one hand and the powder in the other hand, and saying, "I changed him, Daddy!" And, you know, to tell you, to let you know how sick I am, the first thing I said was, "Mercy, don't move. Don't you move." And I ran downstairs, and I got a plastic bag, because I thought, you know, I'm going to need evidence. No one's going to believe how badly I really had it. The whole place was like that. So I put Nikki in the bag, and then I came back. And when I got back, Mercy was actually going like this. She was patting her sleeper. "I changed him!" In the whole room. And I stood there at that point, and I literally had tears in my eyes. I said, "How in the world am I going to clean this up? How am I going to fix this? How am I going to bring it back to the state of perfection that I had it in the first place?" Right? And that, if you remember last week, is the story of Genesis. Remember the first chapters of Genesis. We're preaching through the life of Abraham, but the context is the first 11 chapters. And remember, in the first 11 chapters, God created everything, and it was utterly perfect. And he placed Adam and Eve in the garden, and he said, "Everything is perfect. Let's just keep it this way. The only thing you don't have to do is don't touch this tree. Don't eat of it." What did they do? They ate of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And when they ate of the tree, it would be one thing if just it affected that tree. If it's Mickey, I wouldn't have been very upset if its powder was only on Mickey. But when Adam and Eve sinned, it affected every aspect of creation. Everything from ceiling to floor, everything that was touched was completely and utterly covered and affected by sin. And so the question, of course, is, how am I going to fix this? How is God going to take care of this? And right as soon as it happens, we have this sort of veiled promise. And the veiled promise is this. You remember God says, you know, the seed of the woman will come, and he will crush the head of the serpent, and the head of the serpent will strike his heel. And, you know, and you say, okay, so God has promised he's going to fix it. And immediately after, what happens? It doesn't get better, it gets worse. Remember Cain and Abel. Cain kills Abel. And after that, you think, okay, God's going to fix it now after Cain and Abel. This is really bad. And what happens? except that God looked down upon the earth and saw that every thought of their men's hearts were only evil continually. So what does he do? We see Noah, right? He preserves Noah in the ark, but he brings judgment on everyone else. And we think, oh, beautiful, Noah. Noah's going to fix everything. And as soon as Noah gets off the ark, what happens? He gets drunk. Right? You can imagine being cooped up on an ark for a year. You get drunk as well. But nonetheless, he got in trouble because of his drunkenness. And then after that, you say, okay, well, maybe he's going to do something there. And then you have the Tower of Babel. And it only gets worse that the nations now, instead of having this one thing in the middle that's going to save them, they're completely spread out over the face of the earth. And you say, what's going to happen now? It's sort of like dynamite. You know, I don't expect many of you have worked with demolitions. But let me explain to you. When you light dynamite, when you light a fuse, the dangerous thing is, you have a long fuse, is when you light it, sometimes as soon as you light it, it looks like it goes out. But really what's happening is it's burning on the inside. And the danger that people always make is it's burning on the inside, and they don't realize that, so they go and try and light it again, and as they're lighting again, what happens? It blows up in their face. And that's what was happening in Genesis 1 through 11, that God came with that initial promise. He says, I will, the seed of the woman will crush the seed of the serpent. And he lit the fuse, if you will, to redeem us. And then all of a sudden, it looked like it had gone out, but really it hadn't. It was burning on the inside ever so slowly. And then in Genesis 12, what we have is, if you've ever seen a fuse burn, all of a sudden you have these flares that go, where it's really big, and you know it's happening now. And in Genesis 12, what we have is Abraham. God coming to Abraham. And he starts it, baby. That's where everything starts, if you remember last week. And in the life of Abraham, what we see is Abraham was this pagan. He was a pagan in the land of Ur, of the Chaldees, and he came from a family of moon worshippers, and he had a very comfortable life, and all of these things. His only problem was that his wife was barren. She couldn't have children. And so what God does is he comes to this pagan and out of nowhere and says, Abraham, follow me. He says, I want you to go to a place where I will show you. He says, I want you to leave your country and your relatives and your household, everything, and follow me. And so the call of Abraham, we saw that established last week. But what does God do as well? He doesn't just call him to obey something amorphous. He calls him and says, go to this land and I will do something for you. He promises him something. He says, I promise that I will make you a great nation. He says, I will bless you. And I will make your name great. And he says, Abraham, I will make you a blessing to all peoples. All the families of the earth, Abraham, will be blessed in you. And whoever blesses you, I will bless. And whoever curses you, I will curse. And we remember last week, we saw what this established. This established the promise of God. And in fact, it established the coming of Jesus. Because Jesus came, and what did he say? He said, remember the promise that God made to Abraham, that he would be a blessing to all nations. He says, I'm it, baby. And Jesus comes. Remember, the Jews didn't believe him. And they said, we don't believe that. What have you got to do with Abraham? And Jesus said, what? He says, your father Abraham looked forward to my day and was glad. And he saw it and rejoiced. And they said, how did Abraham see you? You're only 50 years. You're not even 50 years old. And Jesus said, before Abraham was, I am. Boom, boom, boom. And so last week we saw this thing called the gospel sort of established. That God is setting in this plan of redemption that is about him calling us unto himself, and in the process he makes us certain promises. And so what we're going to see today, we're going to look at that same passage, Genesis 1 through 12, 1 through 3, except instead of looking at it directly, we're going to look at the same passage through the eyes of the New Testament, through the letter that this was written to the Hebrews. And so all of that said, we're going to look at basically what Abraham's life, not established, but what Abraham's life modeled for us. Abraham's life models something huge for us, and what it models is this thing called belief in the gospel. Believing the gospel. You hear me say that all the time. I know if you come here on any regular basis. What Abraham's life models for us is what it means to believe the gospel. And if I define that further, what I mean by that is what it means to trust the promises of God. And if you're thinking about the Christian faith, at least, faith is believing the promises of God. Every other religion, sort of faith, is sort of a leap in the dark, if you will. It's sort of, well, I'm going to jump out there and we'll see how it goes. Christian faith is not like that. What faith is that you believe that God has made certain promises, and not only that, but you believe that he is able to keep them. And so what we're going to see this morning, really, is Abraham's faith and what that models for us. And basically, we're going to look at three things this morning. Basically, that Abraham's faith, and therefore our faith, is, first of all, it's evidenced by obedience. Okay, it's evidenced by obedience, it's tested by adversity, and it's motivated by vision. Okay, so all of that said, Let's look at Hebrews 11. If it's in your text, let me read it to you. Hebrews 11:8 starts by saying, "By faith, Abraham, when he was called, obeyed by going out to a place which he was to receive for an inheritance. And he went out, not knowing where he was going. By faith, he lived as an alien in the land of promise, in a foreign land, dwelling in tents with Isaac and Jacob, fellow heirs of the same promise. For he was looking for the city which has foundations, whose architect and builder is God." So the first point this morning, if you're a note taker, is simply this, that faith is evidenced by obedience. Now, if you think about this, think about what Abraham must have felt like. God came to him in his comfort and said to him, "Abraham, I want you to go out into a place that you do not know. I just want you to go." So here's the God. First thing Abraham has to decide is if this God is even worthy of obeying. What gives him the right to even make a command? What gives him the right to be obeyed? The second thing he had to consider was, is he trustworthy? And so Abraham had to think to himself, this God has come to me, and he has called me out of my bondage, if you will, and he is saying he wants me to go to some place that I've never seen, and he has promised to make me a great nation. Remember I said last week, it takes two things to be a nation. It takes a land, which Abraham did not have, and it takes people, which Abraham was not able to produce because his wife was barren. And so what Abraham had to do was sort of mull over this promise. Now, how silly would it be, how silly would we think Abraham was, whether you're a Christian or not, if you read this story and God came to him and said, "Abraham, I want you to go to this place, and I'm going to make you a great nation, I'm going to give you heirs, I'm going to do everything." And then what if Abraham would have stayed in Ur and just said, "Okay, I believe that," but never went? What would we think of Abraham? We would think that was silly. Because we would say to ourselves, "Abraham, if you really believe this guy, this God, when he promises you something, then you'll simply go. You'll act on his promise." And that's why faith is evidenced by obedience. You see, faith without obedience is useless. It's not faith at all. Because what faith is, Abraham looked at God and he said, "I will go." And by going, he evidenced that he trusted the promise of God. When God said he was going to give him something, he believed that. Otherwise, why go? Okay. And the same kind of faith is evidenced by Jesus. The same kind of faith is evidenced by Jesus. Most people don't think of it this way. Jesus' life, among other things, was defined by faith. Most of us look to Jesus and we say, you know, Jesus came and he had to die on the cross because of our sins, and he sort of gutted it out until it was all over. And then when it was all over, he sort of got to enjoy the fruits of his labor. And you know what? The cross, Jesus did have to go to the cross to pay for our sins. The cross was a necessary evil. But Jesus didn't gut it out. Jesus did not gut out the cross. In fact, what enabled Jesus to go to the cross was his faith. What enabled Jesus to go to the cross was the fact that he believed the gospel. That is, he believed the promise of God. God promised Jesus, "When you are lifted up, I will draw all men unto yourself. And you will go down and you're going to live this life of misery, and you're going to die a miserable death on the cross. And after 3 days, I will raise you. I will not let my Holy One see decay." And so Jesus had to think to himself, either my Father means that or he doesn't mean that. And if he does mean that, then what? I must go. And so Jesus believed the gospel. If you don't believe me, if you have Bibles, look at 1 Peter. I've read this to you before, but it's very instructive. 1 Peter chapter 2. Peter says, "For you have been called for this purpose, since Christ also suffered for you, leaving you an example for you to follow in his steps, who committed no sin, nor was any deceit found in his mouth. While being reviled, he did not revile in return. While suffering, he uttered no threat." Now, it would be very easy for us to stop there and say, you know what, when life gets hard, when God calls you to do something hard, you just need to suck it up and fake it until you make it. But that's not where it ends. He says that he uttered no threats, but kept entrusting himself to him who judges righteously. And he himself bore our sins in his body on the cross, so that we might die to sin and live to righteousness. For by his wounds you were healed. You were continually straying like sheep, but now you have returned to the shepherd and guardian of your souls. And what Peter is saying, this is the example that we follow. The example that we follow is the example of Abraham and the example of Jesus. That to obey God's call is not to gut it out.
It is not to be duty-driven. To obey God's call is to entrust yourself to Him who judges righteously. It's to say, God, I know You have called me, and I believe that. You know, now what does that mean? You see, some of you, I know, are not Christians. And so what that means is for you, you have to consider the sort of the initial call. Jesus comes to you, and He says, follow Me. Remember the passage from Revelation. I'm the first and the last, the beginning and the end. I was dead, but now I'm alive forevermore, and I hold the keys to death and Hades. He says, follow Me. Do you believe that? Do you trust that? And He says, evidence it by turning from your sin and coming after Me. Some of you need to consider, do I even believe, A, that Jesus has the right to make that promise to me? On the other hand, if He does have the right, what does it mean for me to trust Him? It means to obey His call. Now, for everyone else, you see, you don't get off the hook either. In fact, it's worse for you. You see, if you have trusted Jesus, if you say, I believe the gospel, then you've got to ask yourself, do I still trust Him now? Do I still trust Him now? Certainly I trusted Him to deliver me from my sins, but do I trust Him now? In the middle of my life, in the middle of hardship, in the middle of everything, you see, the gauge to which you can see, you can gauge to the extent to which you believe the gospel by simply looking at the extent to which you obey the call of Jesus. See, if you're a Christian, you have to ask yourself that. To what extent do I obey the call of Jesus? Because that is the extent to which I really trust in His promises. And you see, if you remember the Old Testament, that's where Israel dropped the ball. Remember, God delivered them from Egypt, and He came to them, and He says, I promise you I'm going to deliver you from bondage, and I'm going to get you into the promised land. I promise. I'm going to finish the job. And Israel went out from Egypt, and as soon as they got in the wilderness, what did they start to do? They complained, and they grumbled, and they began to turn to self-sufficiency and to idols. You see, they did not believe the promise of God. They certainly believed that He delivered them from Egypt because they were no longer there. But as they looked to the promised land, they really didn't believe He would do that, and so what they did was they complained about all of their hardship. And you know what Hebrews 4 says about them? It says they did not enter the promised land because they did not believe what? The gospel preached to them. They didn't believe the gospel. And you see, that's where Israel drops the ball. But I'm not hesitant, but that's where we drop the ball as well. You see, we trust Jesus. And then as soon as we trust Him, we spend most of the rest of our lives going, why is all this hard stuff happening to me? You know, why do I struggle with my sexuality? You know, I thought if I became a Christian, then all of a sudden I'd be better. You know, you look at your children and you say, you know, the Bible says, you know, raise up a child in the way he should go, and then when he is old, he will not depart from it. You know, my children are only 5 years old, and I've already lost them, dog. What is going on? Why is life so hard? And the answer is simply this. It's the faith, point number two, is tested by adversity. You see, it's evidenced by obedience and that you follow Jesus, but faith is tested by adversity. Look at verse 9 in your passage today. Since by faith, verse 8 says he went out by faith Abraham when he was called obeyed, and in verse 9 it says by faith he lived as an alien in the land of promise, as in a foreign land, dwelling in tents with Isaac and Jacob, fellow heirs of the same promise. Think about this again. Think about what Abraham must have felt like. Okay, first he's a comfortable, unbelieving pagan man in Ur of Chaldees. You know, he has a great job at whatever the Chaldean version of Microsoft is, whatever it is, and God says, follow me to the land where I will show you. And he gets to the land, and God doesn't give it to him. He gets to the land, and in fact, remember last week, God appears to him and he says, this is the land. I'm going to give it to your descendants. Right? I can imagine Abraham would say, but you know, I'm here now. I obeyed now, and I'm here. But it didn't work that way. It says he dwelled as an alien in the land of promise. Not only that, it says he dwelled in tents. Remember I told you to watch these editorial comments. So Abraham, when he went to the land of promise, he didn't dwell in mansions of glory. He dwelled in tents. In fact, he was such a stranger in the land of promise that in the land of promise, when his wife Sarah died, Abraham had to buy a plot of land from the people who lived there just so he could bury her. So God promised Abraham he would give him and his descendants this land. He gets there, and all of a sudden, it's not what he thought it would be. And so Abraham has two choices. What are they? To believe that God is going to be faithful anyway, or to pack up his stuff and go home. Right? And that's the choice that you and I have to make. Every day. Every single day. You see, faith is tested by adversity. And you become a Christian and you say, okay, I've become a Christian. Why isn't everything good? You know, that everything is hard now. And the reason we think that is because we have an extremely low, deficient view of adversity. Right? We have a low view of adversity. We have a low view of suffering. You know, just yesterday, the women who went to the conference were meeting. They don't know I was going to say this because I didn't know I was going to say it until now either. They're in our kitchen. They were meeting in our dining room, and I was watching the girls upstairs. And at one point, I walked through the kitchen, and I happened to overhear one of them talking about Johnny Erickson Tada speaking. And you say, I know it, Johnny Erickson Tada. And she is a paraplegic. She's bound to a wheelchair. And basically, the comment was something like that when she got to heaven, she would thank God for her wheelchair. I just heard that passing through, and I just began to cry, and I just went upstairs. I thought, how stupid is she? How could anyone thank God for a wheelchair? How could anyone thank God for adversity? How could anyone thank God when bad things happen? How could anyone thank God when my children are going astray? How could anyone thank God when I fall over and over again sexually and I don't know what to do and I'm at the end of my rope? How am I supposed to thank God for that? And the answer is very simple. You remember Calvin, Book 3, Chapter 9? He opens that chapter and he says, by our tribulation, God weans us from excessive love of this present life. That God says, there is something that is infinitely bigger I have to give to you. And your adversity is not something I sent to you because I hate you. Your adversity is something I sent to you because I love you so very much that I will not let you be satisfied with anything but me. That's the point of adversity. And you say, how am I supposed to make it through then? You know, am I just supposed to gut it out and have faith that, okay, you know, I'm just going to believe this. How does that make it any better? You know, basically what adversity is boot camp for glory, if you will. Adversity is boot camp for glory. You know, I went to Ranger School in the Army about, I don't know, 10 or 15 years ago. And Ranger School, if you know anything about it, it's 58 days long. They feed you one meal a day. You get about 2 hours sleep a night, and you march 10 or 15 miles a day. And I went in the dead of winter, so I got hypothermia twice, and I almost died. I had frostbite on my ears. I went home to Florida, and people have said, why are your ears black? And the question you get over and over again is, why would you do that? Because you know what happens when you graduate from Ranger School? You get to go to Ranger Battalion. You just do it for 365 days out of the year. It isn't like it gets better. So the question really is, why in the world would you do that? And the reason you would do it is for this. For graduation day. You put up with all the suffering and all of the misery because there comes a point, graduation day, that those who have made it stand up there, and you're completely dirty. I went into Ranger School at 155 pounds, and I graduated at 123. And so you're standing there looking as if you just come from Dachau, and you're dirty, and you're ugly, and you're messy, and you smell. But when they come to you, and they pin that Ranger tab on you, and in a sense say, well done, my good and faithful servant. That makes everything worth it. And if you're going through Ranger School, you look forward to the end, and you say, at the end, I'm going to be glorified. At the end, I'm going to be exalted. At the end, I'm going to be shown that this adversity, in fact, will have paid off. And that's the point of adversity. That adversity is a boot camp for glory, that we only have so much glory in this life, little snippets, if you will. But someday there's coming a time when those little tiny snippets, that feeling that I had on graduation day, will be all the time. It will be continuous. And you see, that is what motivates us. That's the third point. You know, the faith is evidenced by obedience, and it's tested by adversity, but it is motivated by vision. Faith is motivated by vision. It's motivated by seeing something out there that no one else sees. Look at verse 10. In verse 10, it says, well, let me pick up in verse 9. He lived as an alien in the land of promise, as in a foreign land, dwelling in tents with Isaac and Jacob, fellow heirs of the same promise. Why? For he was looking for the city which has foundations, whose architect and builder is God. Basically, Abram went to the land of promise, And instead of being in the land of promise and continually looking at his situation and continually looking at his adversity and continually complaining about the fact that he didn't get what God promised him right now, Abram said, there's something bigger and better that I am looking forward to. In fact, it is so big and so good that I cannot even see it. I don't know what it is, but I know it's got to be better than any of this. It is another city. It's not like the cities around here. The cities that are around here are just like the cities I left. You should realize that. It wasn't that you go to the land of promise. It would be no different than moving from San Francisco to Seattle or something. You still have the same problems. You have the same adversity, the same troubles. It's what Abram did. He went to the land of promise, and he said, I look forward to the city whose architect and maker is God. That motivated him. That is what pulled him along, if you will. And guess what? That's the same thing that motivates us and pulls us along. That we, just like Abraham, are motivated or should be motivated because we look to a city whose maker and architect is God. But the beautiful thing that we have that Abraham does not have is we have the blueprint. We can see the blueprint of this city. And it is unbelievable. The city that we see is everyone's dream. It is the Republicans' dream, right? Because it is moral and there's no welfare, right? It is the liberal Democrats' dream. Why? Because there's no suffering. And all tribes and nations and all sexes are gathered around the same thing. And there's complete unity and there's complete beauty. It's everyone's dream. What is that city? It's in the Bible. It's right at the end in Revelation. Let me read it to you. Revelation 21. At the end, John says, this is at the very end of all things. He says, then I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and there was no longer any sea. And I saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, made ready as a bride adorned for her husband. And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, behold, the tabernacle of God is among men, and he will dwell among them, and they will be his people. And God himself will be among them, and he will wipe away every tear from their eyes, and there will no longer be any death, there will no longer be any mourning or crying or pain. The first things have passed away. And he who sits on the throne said, behold, I am making all things new. And he said, write these words, for they are faithful and true. Then he said to me, it is done. I am the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end. I will give to the one who thirsts from the spring of water of life without cost. He who overcomes will inherit these things, and I will be his God. And he will be my son. You see, if you've ever read, if you're in business at all, I'm sure you have read the seven habits of highly effective people, right? And what is habit number one? Begin with the end in mind. And if you remember what Covey says there, is he says, you know, look forward to your funeral and your eulogy and think of what you want everyone to say about you when you are dead. And, you know, you want them to say that you're a good father or a good businessman, whatever. And once you realize what you want people to say about you once you're dead, then you go back and you begin and you sort of, you make for yourself a preferable future. You gut out, if you will. You work hard to make sure that the preferable future is obtained. And you know what the gospel says? It says the same thing. It says we begin with the end in mind. But unlike Covey, we do not envision a preferable future and then gut it out to get there. What we do is we envision a certain future. We envision a certain future where there is no more crying, where there is no more tears, where there is no more mourning or weeping, there is no more racism, there is no more sexism. That you remember, the last thing in the book says, remember Adam and Eve were barred from the garden. They had no more access to the tree of life. At the end of the book of Revelation, it says, and the tree of life was there. And all of the nations gathered round, and its trees, the leaves of its trees came down and were healing for the nations. But that is where we are going. And the beautiful thing about the gospel is because that Jesus has come now, and he dwells in us now, is that is happening now. Remember the vision for our church, even, that we talked about several weeks ago. The vision of our church is simply this, that because of the gospel, the city of Seattle will begin to look more and more like the city of God. That you can taste that even now. And the beautiful thing about it is that not only are we motivated by this great vision, but Jesus himself is motivated by this vision. That Jesus was motivated by this vision of the great city, but we're motivated because we get to go to that city and dwell with Jesus. You know what motivated Jesus? That he would get to go to that city and dwell with you. That's hard to imagine, I guess. Let me close with Hebrews 12. The writer says this. He says, let us lay aside every encumbrance and sin which so easily entangles us, and let us run with endurance the race set before us, fixing our eyes on Jesus, the author and perfecter of our faith, who for the joy set before him endured the cross, despising its shame, and sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. For consider him who has endured such hostility against sinners himself, so that you will not grow weary and lose heart. But the primary motivating factor in the life of Jesus was that he would dwell with you. Think about that. Let me pray. Jesus, we thank you that you have seen fit to draw us unto yourself, and we thank you that you